KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elvis Mitchell, and thanks for listening to The Treatment. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today, however, are not on the big screen, but they can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the world. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You may think my guest, writer, producer, director Greg Berlanti is somebody who specializes in the coming-of-age stories. You've seen Everwood, or he got his start on Dawson's Creek, or one of my favorite shows on what used to be called, back in the 20th century, the WB, Jack and Bobby. He brought one of those characters from Jack and Bobby, or the name, to the show Brothers and Sisters when he ran that show for a while.
Yeah.
I'm geeking out here. But you can now kind of know him since, I guess 3 years ago now, as a man who's been developing DC Comics characters for television. He first brought Arrow to the small screen a couple of seasons ago, and this year, his newest triumph, and one of my favorite shows around, is his adaptation of the old DC comic favorite, The Flash. First of all, Greg, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really exciting.
One of the things I mentioned to you when I met you a few months ago, and that I like about what you've done with Flash, you've taken it back to the show's origins of being sort of rooted in science, but having a really kind of a light on its, I hate to use that term phrase, but it's really got kind of a pop exuberance to it, the kind of lightness that the old run of The Flash had when it was developed by John Romita and Carmine Infantino in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, our hope always was for it that it would have a lot of the qualities that Jeff Johns and myself and Andrew Kreisberg, who all developed it together, would have when we read the books. You know, whether they were the old books from the Silver Age that we found, or whether it was from Crisis of Infinite Earths around that time, the Marv Wolfman run.
Well, The Flash took on a much, much darker turn.
It's where The Flash, it was actually my introduction to The Flash. I started getting into comics about that time. I was 13 years old, and he died in that, spoiler alert, 30 years later. He died, and I was about 13, and I remember crying in a comic book shop. And, you know, the comic book owners back then weren't geeks. They were kind of gruff guys who thought they could make a few bucks.
Don't get tears in that kid.
Looked over at me and he said, it's not free.
At least you didn't say move your hand.
Exactly. So I started reading a lot of the Flash comics back then, the older stuff. After that I went back just because I sort of fell in love with the character and that he was... it was the ultimate sacrifice, and he didn't have the strength or the power necessarily of the other heroes at the time, but he had the heart of a hero, and I was so emotionally connected to him. And so our hope really was that we would craft a show that had that same kind of quality of emotional accessibility and fun, and that's really when I discovered the sort of fun. And it's true in those old books that really, you know, in addition to sort of post Superman, when the Flash was introduced almost 75 years ago, it'll be 75 years next week, it exploded this whole other run of other secondary kind of characters. And he was sort of the foremost secondary character after Superman to really sort of explode that generation of comic books.
And the group that became the Justice Society.
Exactly. And so it was a lot of, they were fun. There was a little bit of a science lesson in there, you know, but he wore his heart on his sleeve. He sort of couldn't believe that he had these abilities himself. He was trying to make a relationship work with Iris. You know, it was sort of in its lightheartedness, it was revolutionary. And so we really, you know, you always, again, you set out with the best of intentions when you do these things, and you never know if everything will click, if you'll get the right actors, if you'll get the right director, if you'll have cracked the right story to launch it, if the visual effects component of the show would have been caught up to sort of what we all saw in our heads. And in this particular instance, all of those things really worked. And it's as much by luck as by design. And so we're really lucky.
That's interesting, because you're basically saying the time was right to do it now, just in terms of what you could do for television as compared to what you have to do to make it work as a film. Because I guess like almost 25 years ago now, there's a Flash series, and you actually have the actor who played the
Barry Allen of The Flash in the 90s playing the father of this Barry Allen.
Right. John Wesley Shipp, who I worked with on Dawson's Creek. And again, Jeff Johns and myself and Andrew Kreisberg were all fans of that show and really fans of what it was trying to do in that moment, which I think was also sort of really kind of pushing boundaries for television. You know, we had heard some horror stories, I'm not sure if they're apocryphal or not, of the show having been taken off a few times because they couldn't make air dates because of the amount of visual effects for the show in that moment. So whether or not that was true, I kept repeating it to everybody, so everybody was really scared so that we were all working overtime to make sure we all made our air dates. Because, you know, again, we can have, we sort of have these notions of, you know, can we try this? What if we did this? And we had a pilot that, you know, we had a lot more time for and more money. And the concern going in for us and for, I think, the fans and for critics and whatnot was, are they going to be able to maintain this level of, forgetting even the quality, but just this level of fun and the visual effects kind of handiwork. And Armin Kevorkian, who's our visual effects supervisor, him and I met a few shows ago. And
did you meet him?
I met him on a show called The Tomorrow People.
Oh, gosh, sure, yes.
Which was short-lived, but we had actually done a little teeny bit of work on Political Animals before that. He'd come in and helped out, but it was Tomorrow People where just with teleportation, he gave it a kind of a look on TV that I thought, wow, this is on a TV schedule. If we can sort of, and it looks like a feature films kind of version of teleportation, if we could do that with the Flash's power, now may be the moment, you know? And, you know, just sort of not fully answering your question, but kind of segueing to sort of how we do that, we treat it like it's an animated show. And in that,
do you have that time?
Exactly.
That time?
So we have that kind of element of time because if he's, in essence, an animated character a sixth of the time in the episodes. So the second we have the story ideas, Armin and his team start prevising sequences. And even by the time the directors kind of get there, we have sort of previses that are handed to them that they get creative about and augment and make
so
their changes
to. So in
effect,
you have a second of basically a second unit working all the time on the show.
We do. We have and they're animators and they're visual effects artists, and some of them, you know, are coming off of huge features and want to be here because they love The Flash. I mean, that's the other thing that, you know, that starts to happen when you do a show like this is so many people are brought to it, I think, because of their own love of the comic books. And they put that extra bit of time and care and energy into it because they're working on Grodd for the first time and they want, you know, Gorilla Grodd to be as cool as it was for them in the comic book. So you get that level of commitment from everybody. And I think it really shows on the screen.
One of the other things that shows on the screen, too, is you cast an actor, Grant Gustin, who looks like the Carmine Infantino Flash. He's lean. He looks like a distance brother rather than looking kind of bulkier and more muscular, which I thought actually adds a kind of visual elegance to that character as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, we had a really interesting casting challenge for us, which is he had to come in the second season of Arrow.
In the scientist episode.
Exactly, in episodes 8 and 9. And so, you know, we knew he wasn't yet going to be powered, so he wouldn't have that sort of going for him. And he had to come on and not seem like just a guest star we could have on every episode. He had to sort of really seem and feel like he could be the center of a show. And he had to come into a moving train of a show that was working and establish himself, minus his powers, as the heart and soul of this character, Barry Allen. And so we were looking for someone that we could build a show around, knowing that that's where we wanted to go with it.
So
that could also hold their
own. You were saying before we got started that Flash was a character you had your eye on for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved The Flash. It was the first picture I downloaded onto my it's turned off now, onto my iPhone when I got it 4 or 5 years ago or whatever. It's you know, he's
which
just...
Which version of The Flash was it?
It's the old Carmen Infantino version of him dashing at the camera.
We should say that Carmen Infantino was the artist who did the Silver Age Flash. And even in that animation, just before we get back to Grant, just his special effect, you sort of see like the yellow and the red. That's really kind of a tribute to the Infantino Flash illustration, isn't it?
Right, yeah. We do that on the show, and it's, again... We didn't know that we were going to try that until we didn't know exactly how it would look when he ran. There was a lot more. When we shot the pilot, we used a lot more of a stuntman and practical stuff. And then we had digitized him. And I'm not even sure what other shows, if there's any other shows besides the shows we're working on, that have full active digital doubles now, but we do. And so there was an episode that aired just last night, the Grodd episode, and there are whole scenes with Grodd and Grant or Barry, and they're completely digital. Both of them, and you really wouldn't know it. And we've gotten more courageous, I think, about that as the year has gone on and learned more how to blend real and CG elements of the show. And so there's sometimes, just by the nature of the character, that it can feel a little fake, but it's okay because you're kind of whisked away, I think, in this on the emotional journey of the character.
But you were saying about casting Grant before I interrupted you.
Exactly. So Grant came in, and he was younger than we thought we were going to cast somebody.
Really?
Because he
feels like the age that Barry Allen would be from, again, the 60s Silver Age Flash.
I know. You kind of always thought maybe perhaps he would be a touch older. You know, you think about Wally West is sort of supposed to be the kid Flash and slightly younger. We wondered if he would read too young. But he... His performance, he was just always imbued with this kind of openness and open-heartedness.
It's kind of a gee whiz quality that he has.
And that sometimes I think of him as like this generation's Michael J. Fox, and that he has that kind of affability and charm and humor, but can be really heartfelt, and it never feels saccharine when he is. And he just brought all of that emotion, and he really won the day. I mean, he came in. He was the first guy to come in for us, and we couldn't get him out of our heads as we kept watching other people. And I brought the tape over to the studio, and Peter Roth, I said, he may be a bit younger, but just take a look. Who's the president of Warner Brothers Television? Looked at it and said, well, that's your guy, you know, right away. And same thing when the network saw him. And so right away, everyone just sort of went to work, and he premiered in those episodes, and the fans sort of had that same kind of immediate sort of adulation or adoration of him and reaction to him, and that was great. And then we knew we had to sort of figure out the pilot and surround him with people that he could have fun being in scenes with, that we, you know, would be really dramatic and interesting in a way that, so that when we couldn't afford the visual effects in certain times, that the emotion and the characters of the show would really carry the day.
But that, if we go back to Arrow, and for me, if we go back to really to Jack and Bobby, there's a thing you do so often with these characters who are looking for father figures.
Right.
And that carries over from that show to both Arrow and Flash, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes conscious, sometimes not. But in this instance, it really was conscious. We had talked often about, we compared the show to two movies when we were beginning to work on it. The Right Stuff was one of them. Just in that, we really sort of saw and felt Barry as sort of this human jet, and like at the time, and courageous in the way that the men were in that film.
That film was set in a period where the Flash would be getting started as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, exactly. So I think you sort of feel a little bit of that ode to the space race and that energy of like, you know, the forefront of what was happening at JPL and those kind of things. And then the other was Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Interesting.
Which to me just really dramatized in this way, this boy who had several different fathers. And was really an emotional film and we also talk a lot about, you know, the character as in a metaphor, sort of as an athlete, you know, with, you know, these different sort of coaches, you know. So he has his father who's in prison, who has sort of one set of advice. He has Joe West, who's been his surrogate dad and raised him and has a different connection with him, an emotional connection with him, and is sort of that practical kind of dad in a certain way. And then Harrison Wells, played by Tom Cavanaugh, who is, very much the father that he idolizes and the man of science that sort of he kind of wanted to be.
We should say in this iteration of the show, Harrison is, for a while, was the leader of the team, the benevolent leader of the team,
right.
The sort of Niles Calder, Professor X leader of the team. This is sad how much of this stuff I know.
Very impressive.
not the word I would use. But what I wanted, when you brought up Searching for Bobby Fischer, I actually wanted to ask you about that, because in both Arrow and Flash, you have men of color who are serving as father figures,
yeah,
which brings a really interesting dynamic to all this. And I wanted to know where that came from, if that was a conscious thing for you to do as well in both of these cases.
It was. I mean, I felt like I loved the comic books. You know, obviously they meant a lot to me as a kid.
But they're very white.
And they were made at a different time. And I feel like we have an internal obligation to, you know, heroes are about saving people today, you know, and if they're not connected and the show doesn't look and feel the way our world looks and feels, you know, we're taping this at, you know, Santa Monica College, and you walk around upstairs and it's a diverse world, you know, it's a diverse group of people. And we want the shows to feel that way. We want to tell stories that are informed by that. We want to work with actors that reflect that. I love being a part of something that puts that out there.
We'll have to take a break. My guest, who could find his way around Santa Monica College but can't find his bathroom in his house, I guess this house is so big, is Greg Berlanti. His newest triumph on TV is as developer of the new series, The Flash, is The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, who has the kind of problems that most of us dream about, is Greg Berlanti. His newest show on the CW is Flash. He's also the one of the exec producers and one of the men who developed the show, The Arrow, for CW as well. But you said something. You mentioned political animals, and there's this interest you have in a way that politics and the real world intersect. And this sort of, I guess for you, I wonder where it comes from, the idea where careers mean more than personal lives, and be it politics or these kind of ideal lives, the life of being a superhero or being a politician, trying to separate the ideal from the earthly. Where does that come from for you as a creative person?
That's a great question. I think probably they say write what you know, and I'm very involved emotionally in the stuff that I'm a part of, and I have an emotional commitment to those stories in a way that can consume a large part of my life. And so I think it's often reflected in the characters' journeys that you have gifted characters who are challenged, who want to make the world better, who want to, you know, are really committed to giving them all of themselves or as much of themselves as possible. And then all the sort of human kind of complications that come out of that. That's something that I'm familiar with. So it's often something that I'll write about, you know. And I think a lot of people, it just so happens that I think a lot of people in today's society are actually really familiar with that, in the sense of, you know, how many hours everyone really has to work and put in, and that being pulled between love and family and a commitment to a passion or a career or a calling. And I think that's not uncommon.
I guess as I was thinking about this, though, one of the things I want to ask you about, too, is just that idea of really sort of spreading things out so you have often in these things you do an older actor with real power,
right,
who's kind of like almost in some ways like a mentor to a younger actor even,
right,
too. We get to see that kind of relationship of a shift in confidence,
right,
and that goes back to Everwood, I think, for you, doesn't it?
It does. And again, I think part of it when I was first drawing that up was wish fulfillment on my own part of, like, you know, I felt like I really identified with every kid is sort of looking for that mentor, you know, especially for myself as a young artist when I moved out here, you know, and then you'll ultimately discover, at least I feel like I discovered, you have to kind of be those things for yourself. And that the, you know, yes, sometimes you'll meet people in this business that actually live up to and or exceed your expectations of them, but many times you meet people who don't, you know, and so you live with that too. And so, yeah, that's really reflected, I think. But again, probably the primary reason for it is to have scenes where you have scenes between Tom Cavanaugh and Grant Gustin. You have scenes between Jesse Martin and Tom Cavanaugh on a show that, you know, people were coming to expecting, oh, I'm just going to see a guy running really fast and some teeny bopper love story. And then you get those scenes of real surprise and gravitas. And you know, we as writers are inspired by what we watch them do. And that drives us to aim even higher. And it's like I always say it's like a game of tennis. Like, we serve the scripts up there to Vancouver where they shoot them. We get back the dailies. It's like the ball coming back our way. It's coming back even faster because they're really great. And then that makes us go, oh my gosh, we really have to crack a great story for them next time. Or, you know, we have to take this character and put them in a scene with this person. Or what would we want to see Cisco do? What if Cisco and Joe had this relationship, you know? And so that's sort of how it all grows.
It's The Treatment. My guest, the man who brought Barry Allen from Catch Me If You Can to The Flash on the CW, is Greg Berlanti. But in some ways, though, it's almost like opposite, sort of the contrast of enthusiasm and sort of, I don't want to say cynicism, but that, right, it gets close to that.
Yeah, there's always that darkness. I mean, a real interesting thing was when we were constructing Barry Allen and we knew we wanted him to be different from Oliver Queen. What we went with, the notion was, is that Oliver really is this pessimist on the outside, but inside he's an optimist because he actually had a great upbringing.
And a great life, and had that taken, snatched away from him.
Snatched away from him when he ended up on, you know, on the island, and had to sort of remake himself. And then, so deep down is still that a guy who believes like, oh, if I work hard and I fix this and I do this, things will work out, you know. And The Flash, we did the flip, which is, you know, he was a kid who had this devastating thing happen to him as a child. His mother was murdered right before his, pretty much right before his eyes.
And nobody believed him when he told the story.
Nobody believed him when he saw it, what actually happened that night. And his father was sent to prison for that murder. And so, and it actually becomes part of the narrative of, you know, well, what kind of man will that make? And we found out subsequently that Wells did that, in fact, hoping that it would make a villain. And just the opposite happened. You know, it made this guy who's even more hopeful, who's even more optimistic. But underneath that is this pessimism and this darkness, I think, that you see come out in flashes of, no pun intended.
it's your show.
you see come out in those brief moments of, he's still a guy who's running from something. And I asked Jeff Johns the other day.
I wish that Jeff comes from the world of comics and then moved into to TV and is actually, like me, a fellow Detroiter. So.
Oh, great. Yes, exactly. And a proud one. and so he brought Barry Allen back in the comics with his run Rebirth, which very much brought the character back, I think, in the consciousness.
And also had a kind of similar sort of level of emotional truth to close to what the kind of stuff you do.
Totally. And he added that backstory. And I said to him, you know, it works so elegantly. It's like it was always there. You know, it fits so elegantly. It's rare that somebody retcons someone's character's backstory. And you believe it. And it's so natural. It makes total sense.
Usually it feels like an add-on to sort of explain things. In this case, it did not.
And it did not. And he said, I wanted something he was always running from. You know, which I thought was so great and so brilliant. And that as fast as he ran, he would never figure it out, you know. You know, there is, in a lot of ways, we call it the original sin. You know, it was the thing that sort of created him. And next year's season, we'll deal more directly with, you know, okay, other things are going well in Barry's life, but why is that root problem still there and still gnawing at him?
I'm glad you said that, because there's that aspect of almost a kind of a Catholic guilt that exists in all these things that you've done.
Right. Well, I am Catholic. Oh. And I was an altar boy. And I was an altar boy for 5 years and served a mass with Cardinal O'Connor of New York.
Did you?
Yep. At the time.
I know the pictures of you doing that at the house.
It was interesting because I was probably 13, 14. I was realizing I was gay. I went down to serve that mass, and there was all this ACT UP activity was happening at the same time right around the church. So I was seeing this, probably the largest group of gay men that I'd ever seen, and women at the time, you know, marching to try and change the laws in New York and to try and help people who were suffering from AIDS at the moment, and knowing that I had this secret, but was trying to still be, you know, a good little altar boy.
And going to be involved in an institution that was not particularly open-minded towards
right.
anybody of any real difference at all.
Right, yeah. So that was, I remember that day vividly. Because it was such a contrast, you know, between sort of and probably, I mean, again, to sort of segue into sort of back into kind of what we were talking about, why I identified with these characters who I felt like had these sort of secrets, you know, who wanted to help people but didn't feel they were like them, you know, the people that they wanted to help.
That's so interesting, because as you describe that scene, Cardinal O'Connor, that could be a scene from anything you've done where we see our protagonist sort of in the middle of two or three different worlds and right. still having to ask himself questions that he hasn't answered personally yet.
Right.
I mean, that really is something you bring to a lot of what you do, isn't it?
I try and bring that, I've had most success when I've been really authentic with the things that I've been doing. And when I haven't, it's often been just because it was an opportunity that sounded really cool or interesting, but it didn't have that same level of heart or that reason that I sort of felt like I had to push myself that extra bit. So,
I mean, because what you're talking about, being so close to these two things, these two different worlds in that circumstance, both of which clearly mean a lot to you, because one is this thing in which you've been raised, but right. it's also this thing that as you come to understand your own sexuality and who you yeah. are, you understand that they're completely opposed to that. And these other people this other group who wants to make a difference and wants to change things,
right.
but you still have a feel to this thing that you've been raised in.
Well, yeah, and feeling that connection to them, you know, and knowing that it would be a long, long time before I'd be able to sort of be on one side of that tape that they were on across the street and where I was, you know, which was walking into St. Patrick's.
And did some part of you want to bridge that gap between them too?
I definitely did. I definitely – but you know, it was a time that was pre-internet. There was no, you really, if you were a gay kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, first of all, I was also growing up at the time of AIDS, and so, you know, you kind of were taught to believe, well, that equals death. You know, there was something intuitive about that that was terrifying, and it was just when you were realizing your own sexuality. And you didn't know who to reach out to or who to talk to. You'd hear murmurs about, well, maybe this actor's gay, or maybe this person's gay, or maybe this person in your community is gay. And so I remember that day because I remember thinking, looking at that sea of people and thinking, like, they're all like me, but I can't tell anybody. You know?
You were there with your secret identity.
Yes, exactly.
I guess as you're talking about this, though, I think about how so often there's sort of secrets and guilt. You said that's really very much a part of what you do as a writer, too, isn't it?
I think trying to overcome those things, you know, and succeed and have the characters succeed in spite of whatever fears or worries that they may have.
I mean, I'm not trying to probe here, but I just...
No, yeah, probe. I don't care.
Okay, good. We got another 2 or 3 hours left now. No, but as the last question, just that I think that's where that emotion that plays like melodrama, I mean,
right.
that epic sort of operatic emotion comes from,
right.
Is that because the idea, and so often in the shows, there's comedy and then there's a sort of a glide into melodrama in the same scene.
Right.
And just as you described that episode in your life, having all these things happen, being maybe giddy at the idea, excited seeing all this group of gay people who you hope would be your world, but you can't say anything to them. And also this excitement of getting this chance to have this big opportunity in your life with the church,
right.
and the happiness that comes from that, but kind of the awfulness of having these things come up. I mean, I can't think of an episode of something you've done that doesn't touch on a lot of those things.
Well, I'm glad you appreciate the tone, because I think the tone is something that I do work really hard for, and because so many times this day and age, you get pressure from executives or whatnot to sort of put everything in a box. Okay, this is a comedy. This is a romantic comedy. This is a drama. And I don't think life exists like that. I personally believe that life has all of those elements, and you have emotion, and you have pain, and you have joy, and they all kind of swirl together, and a moment can be completely hysterical 1 minute and terrifying the next, and that mixture and match of tones is something that I try to have in all the stuff we do. It allows for us to write tonally different shows and episodes. It allows the actors to play tonally different things. And we cast people who do have that great range, I think, and who can shift those gears in a minute. And I actually think it makes each of those things richer. So it makes the comedy funnier because you're like, it's a nice release to get that laugh. And it makes the emotion... You know, I think a lot of times emotion's given a bad rap in TV and movies, especially in action films or action shows, because people will say, well, is that too melodramatic or too emotional? If it's genuine and it's authentic, I don't think it is. Now, you have to write it in a genuine way. You can't just do it because you say, oh, the character should cry here or this thing should happen here. And when people do that and it's disingenuous, I think it gives a bad name to emotion in these things. And it's easy to say, oh, something was soft because it made you cry. You know, but it's if it's authentic and it's real like that, I think it's a celebration of all those things, the same way that laughing at it or, you know, or a really cool dramatic, you know, set piece makes you feel.
That's a great way to put it. We're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Greg. Please come back.
Thank you.
My guest is Greg Belanti, who may or may not come back. His new show.
Oh, definitely. I'm back. Whatever you want.
I'll shame you into it. Please watch his shows, Arrow, and of course, The Flash, which are concluding the seasons now. Recording engineer who also mixes the shows, Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm not a superhero. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.